Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup.
So every day the shutdown continues to grow is another day that there will be a backlog.
This week, we're looking at the unexpected ways the government shutdown has impacted our food system.
There are nearly 1.6 million New Yorkers who rely on SNAP to feed themselves and their families every single day. There is a real impact on our friends and neighbors.
A lot of farmers rely on commodity loans at the end of the year. Since the offices are not open, those loans aren't available to them.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And good morning. This is the first time I think you might be hearing this new music.
It's fantastic.
On the main course OG.
Thanks, Mickey.
This was created by a good friend of ours, Mickey.
The great Mickey Finn. It sounds sort of like Aaron Copland meets Will Ferrell, Anchorman. It's classic Americana.
I feel like I should be in a suit. And
as performed
live up
by
to...
the Eyewitness News team.
It's so matter-of-fact music. I love it.
I think it's brave. I think it describes musically the American frontier.
Wait until you hear the outro.
It's missing a teletype machine.
That's where they just, like, boot us out of the... When they come in, they're like, you guys need to leave right now. That's the outro.
Also known as the bum's rush.
Yeah. Kicking and screaming.
I think it's like the Oscars. They're like, wrap it up. Hurry.
We always want to go 2 hours.
Brexit.
Oh, no. Patrick broke his mic.
All right.
Good morning. This is the Main Course OG. We are airing live from a rainy Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Emily Pearson, and in studio I have Mike Edison.
Hello.
Brandon Hoy.
Uh-huh.
Daniel Sharp.
Hello.
Patrick Martins.
Yep.
And our guest for the weekly grill is Didi Lahman.
It's Lahman.
Hello. I've been saying it wrong for years.
Sorry.
Yes.
Didi say it like Martha Stewart.
Guys, get in your words because we're not going to get a word in edgewise. Put Didi and Emily. Jewish tetwar is going to call
It's also the Dalai. It's the Dalai Lama.
I listened to your last show. All it was boys fighting with Emily saying, guys, I want to ask a question.
Didi Lahman, co-owner of Clinton Street Baking Co. and Community Food and Juice. And thank you for the scones and muffins this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we're going to jump right in. We haven't been on in a few weeks. Last week we were live from the Mercantile at the Good Food Awards in San Francisco.
I listened to that show. It was good. It was funny.
Good.
I listened.
You listened to your own show, Patrick?
I have about 4 times in 12 years.
Okay. That's a certain level of narcissism we can discuss later.
All right, well, it's our first time back in Brooklyn in a while since before the holidays. So happy New Year, everyone. We're going to jump in. Heritage Radio Network just launched a Hall of Fame celebrating the individuals whose accomplishments in the agriculture, food, and beverage spaces have furthered HRN's mission to make the world more equitable, sustainable, and delicious. We also have a friend, Davia Nelson of the Kitchen Sisters on NPR, who has a recurring segment that documents keepers. These are guardians of history, protectors of the free flow of information and ideas. Name someone who you think needs to be added to one of these lists, whether they're famous or not.
Do we also want to talk about how we got here, how we got to a Hall of Fame? I mean,
yes.
It's also Heritage Radio 10th anniversary, which I believe was the impetus of starting a Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. Was it not, Patrick?
Yeah.
I know this was your grand idea. I sit in the board meetings and you love to discuss this Hall of Fame.
Anytime a place can self-reference itself and award its longtime achievers, that's cool.
Well, that's a long walk for a drink of water, dude. 10 years. To start your Hall of Fame.
Well, it takes all good ideas take time. Time is the greatest ally of good ideas. If it stays for a long time, you know, 10 years is, by the way, not a very long time yet, but, you know, that means, yeah, it has staying power. It has feet, legs.
So HRN's Hall of Fame is each show is nominating or basically appointing one person each month who has been on their show at some point and who they feel should be part of this first wave of the Hall of Fame. So
I nominate Tony Butler.
T-Bone.
All right.
I actually, you know, there's a lot of people, because remember Helen Keller's great quote, the world is not only moved along by the great shoves of its heroes, but also by the tiny pushes of each honest worker, or something like that. And so I like that there's...
let me just sign language.
You had that right at your fingertips, Patrick.
And I just think, like, to use someone, like, for instance, a back waiter at Roberta's. Who's that amazing guy who's been making their mozzarella and all that forever?
Mags. Oh, we call him Mags.
Oh, Magdalena. Yeah, Mags.
So, for instance, to put a guy like that in the Hall of Fame, and he represents all those backbones of the restaurants around the country, especially in the big cities, you know, or a chef, you know, who quietly goes from house to house to cater, and he represents all chefs, you know, who are bringing culture and agriculture, you know, into people's homes.
Who was the first inductee?
So you would, so like in the Baseball Hall of Fame, so in the Baseball Hall of Fame, you would like induct like the guy who comes off the bench and takes a walk every once in a while.
Louis Tiant should be our first guy in the Hall of Fame.
No, a special teamer.
A utility guy.
For football.
Oh, yeah.
Didi, you came out of the media magazine world. Do you have someone from that side of things, or would you be on the culinary side? Or it could just be someone you know who you admire.
Nominating for the HRN.
It doesn't have to be for HRN. It's like if you were a keeper, someone who's...
Well, I think I'm still thinking of Helen Keller there. I'm going to put her at the top of the list.
She's good.
No,
you would have to be blind not to see that she deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
I'm going to think about that, Emily, and get back to you.
All right.
Thanks.
Well, your husband, in many ways.
I don't have a husband.
He's a keeper of all these kind of, I don't want to say Jewish traditions. That might not be correct to say that, but
who are you calling?
Cooking secrets, New York City, ins and outs of the restaurant industry. I mean, he's had a restaurant off and on for 40 years, right, here in the city.
Now you're aging him. No, he has, actually. He's a veteran of 40 years in the city. But I'm trying to understand your Hall of Fame. Isn't it for Heritage Radio Network people, performers and...
What you should be trying to understand is this radio show. It makes no sense.
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
It's more about, you know, heroes. You know, who are your heroes? Who are your mentors?
You could create your own Hall of Fame.
Just make something up.
Patrick certainly is.
I don't like this threat. Let's move on.
All right, we're going to move on.
Thanks.
It is breakfast time. Didi did bring us wonderful scones. We were just at Squirrel in L.A., and the line was literally around the corner.
And how was it?
Fantastic. Good thing we also know the owner.
It's fun. Yeah. Good place.
We didn't wait online.
What did you eat?
Didn't you cut Emma Stone? She let you cut Emma Stone.
Emma Roberts. Emma Roberts.
Yeah,
a kid. Yeah, I mean, she's my age, but I turned around and... Jessica, the owner, had been very kind to, you know, tell me I could go up and the manager would help me. And I look around and I'm already feeling pretty VIP. And like three people behind me is Emma Roberts with her mom. And I was like, oh, and Dennis, my husband, was like, should we go behind her? Like, should we let her go first?
No.
Too important.
Well, that's why we have a rule for celebrities at our restaurant where they do not cut the line. They get everything for free. So they got to wait like everyone else.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Roberta's has been that too, right? You never bent over backward. Although you did give Jay-Z and Beyonce this exact seat that I'm looking at. But...
No, we didn't give it to them. It was there
that's
and available. It was there and available. And also, it's like if you know somebody's going to be fighting, you want to keep them away from everybody else. So there was intent to that move.
Dude, that's the best.
It was for ours. But yeah, I agree with that. I think you know that they oftentimes get all of these things. I think they like places like that where they're like just a regular person. They can come and just be one of us.
I think they like to be overcharged and abused.
I think if I was a celebrity, I'd want it to be, you know, treated like I was normal.
Well, most of them don't, to be honest. And we've had people call us like, oh, so-and-so's, this is so-and-so's handler. Well, they don't call themselves a handler. And she can't wait online right now because she's pregnant. I'll let her go nameless. But so can she come and cut the line? No, she has to wait. Like we have 80 people waiting and she must wait like all the regular people.
Do they tip? Can you generalize?
I don't know. I'm sure they do. We've had many generous tippers. But right now we have a lot of Major League Baseball and basketball players coming in, which makes Neil really excited. I can't name any of them, but they're big.
A-Rod.
A-Rod didn't come. But I agree with you,
I feel like
Brandon.
Celebrities like to pre-
pretend to be normal until they have to be confronted with the reality, and then they pull that celebrity card really fast.
Like a lion. Yeah. Yeah. Like,
celebrities love meatballs. It's a known fact.
Yeah, known. It's a known fact.
Known fact.
Yep.
So part of why I brought this up is also that there just like in general, long lines. Like, is there room for more restaurants in this space, or is there something that people thrive off of? They want to go to the place that has the long line. It wouldn't matter if there were 10 more breakfast places that opened, you know, in the same neighborhood near Clinton or near community, you know. But do people want to be at the place that is sceney and has a line?
Well, I don't know. You first of all, what did you eat at Squirrel, and why did you wait online? That's the question, right?
We didn't.
You didn't.
Did you have the squirrel?
You cut the line.
Well, hold on. We were there twice. I was there twice.
What do you think? They're regular people?
The first day, we were there at a very good time, and there was no line. But we went because, I guess, a little self-promotion. Squirrel is a very big buyer of Heritage Foods Belly, and they make their own in-house bacon with our bellies.
Wow.
So we went to taste what Jessica is making. It was fantastic. We obviously went for her jams, which she is very famous for. So we had the brioche with ricotta and the rainbow of her three seasonal jams. Hmm. And we had an awesome...
Guava.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else? And then there was an
sugar magnolia,
elephant
and
plum
sperm,
jam.
Right? I heard there was sperm jam there. Did I say that? I didn't say that.
Exactly. It goes well with ricotta.
Deaf.
It's all right because Mike's all jammed up.
Deaf is my favorite jam.
Ba-dum-bum.
Okay, so you had the jams and the
ricotta. Then she does these awesome rice bowls. They're like a crispy rice with a crumbled sausage. You can get it with avocado, the whole works. Mm-hmm. And we actually had a porridge, like a chicken and rice porridge. Mm. Patrick, you love sharing soup.
Yeah, I love sharing soup. I also, if there's one food I like to go hiking with, is soup.
Soup for breakfast
hiking.
Is awesome.
It's a great nourishment, hot soup.
We had a few soups on our trip out to California.
I
want to talk about soup for breakfast for a second. Okay. I think soup is like the greatest breakfast in cold weather. I got this idea just going to this Cuban lunch cafe that I used to go, and all the old guys were having like that great Cuban heavy chicken soup for breakfast, the freezing cold days, and I started doing it, and my days were better. And then I later found out that the Chinese army always drank soup, had soup and noodles for breakfast. It was good feng shui for battle and stuff, but I know it seems kind of counterintuitive for most Americans, but chicken soup for breakfast, I say
people
yes.
People have FOMO.
Tell us what a better day is for Mike Edison.
Well, I also tend to correct the soup. That's a problem. You see, my days
that
are,
with alcohol?
My highs are so high that for me, you know, what would be a great day for somebody else is would be crashing low for me.
So all I can think about is all those Chinese men in the bathroom feng shuing their war battle with soup.
Running into battle
soup
with
breakfast.
Like a stomach full of soup.
And then I think
around.
Of Mike in the bathroom after his better day of soup starter.
Mike, you need a clean broth. More like a bone broth.
No.
Nothing else.
Get some carbs, some protein, some fat.
All right.
And maybe a shot of bourbon. Shoju.
Did I tell you guys that Mike's a little jammed up?
Right. That's good. But by the way, my answer to the actual question is the reason there's not more breakfast shop in New York is bagels and cream cheese, which you can get everywhere, and rolls with butter, the famous New York Kaiser roll with butter. That kills.
Or as
diners.
Dee Dee just said, bacon that smells bad, but that must have been delicious. What Mike just ate from the
awesome.
Bodega.
Well, my question is breakfast
bodega
restaurants.
Bacon.
So there's a line around the block on a weekday? Who are these people who have time to go to a restaurant in the morning at a breakfast restaurant that aren't working? Are they furloughed government employees?
Oh,
can't
nice
be because they're not getting
to our next topic.
Well, wait,
can't
wait,
be because they're not getting paid. So who are these elites that can have breakfast during the week and go to a restaurant and wait and have time to wait?
They can eat at the meatball shop.
Yeah, but I'm going to segue. They can eat if they're not paid. So the meatball shop and other chefs around the country are offering house accounts to any furloughed government employees during the shutdown where you eat now and pay later. A very noble cause.
What's
Daniel
the vague?
Sharp. So tell us a little bit more about this and sort of how it works. And for the rest of you, is the government shutdown affecting each of you at all in your businesses, in your travel, as it relates to food personally?
Yeah, so we wanted to come up with a way to kind of, you know, I don't know if give back's the right word or just, you know, spot you until you're, you know, on a more solid footing.
I think drug dealers call it a front.
A front, yeah.
It's like just the house account in Olson's Mercantile and Little House in the Prairie, where you get to go in and get gumballs and
two for a penny.
That's like
we penny get candy.
You got points on the package, and you got to come. We come later to collect. No. So basically we're drug dealers. I think that, you know, we just opened a Washington, D.C. location, and I think being new to that market, it actually, I think, caught us a little off guard how much of a government town it is when this shutdown happened. All of a sudden, we were like, oh, like, wow, okay. And all the restaurants down there are being hit and impacted like that. The entire, the entire town, if people don't work in government, they work with people who are in government. So the whole place is kind of slowed way, 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 way down. So, we're offering you to be able to come in. And, you know, I know most of these employees, thankfully, are being guaranteed that they will be paid eventually. So they just don't have the cash in hand. So, you know, we're gonna honor, you pay us back when you can.
Are you limiting it to food only, like no alcohol?
I believe so, but
I was just curious.
I actually don't know.
Okay,
but that's very kind of you and generous. Bravo.
Yeah, it's very smart.
Yeah.
So
no, and honestly, if supermarkets aren't doing that, then I think there are more people that are probably eating out is a great option.
And it's actually a good demographic to trust to put that olive branch of trust with, because I mean, government employees, there's something noble about them. They're almost like working for a nonprofit.
Yeah. Well, we're offering a soup starter every morning for furloughed employees. Mike, you can be number one in the
All right. I love a soup for breakfast.
Uh-huh. I heard that. You and the Chinese.
Yeah. Mike's been furloughed for so long. he actually has started calling it retirement.
Yeah. Mike, you have your ID? Dee Dee's carding at the door. You got to make sure to...
My government ID?
Yeah.
You and Cardi B. For soup starters.
I like this. I'm getting soup. I'm getting meatballs.
Yep.
Well, I have a question about, since we're talking about balls, what about burgers? In-N-Out Burger seems to be elevated into its own category of fast food. Why is that? Is it really just as bad as or lowbrow as McDonald's and Burger King? Daniel, Brandon, you're both California natives. What is it that makes people love it so much?
I had a friend who was an East Coaster, went to West Coast and had In-N-Out and was like, I don't get what the big deal is. So I think there's something to be said for that. It's something that you grow up with. But then I thought more about it and decided he just had shitty taste.
Yeah, no. Wait. Yeah. East Coasters just went out there and it was awesome.
It's great. I think that, you know, at its core, I don't think it's fundamentally different than any fast food restaurant, except I think it's stayed true to what it was. It's very simple. Everything is done in a very... they don't do too much. They're still just flipping burgers like probably McDonald's was in the 50s. But now you go to a McDonald's and it looks like, you know, a high-tech, like, microwave oven, you know. So I think, and, you know, In-N-Out, they just always have a line. So there's always, you know, that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges. It's like, how do you, you know, keeping food moving out the door quickly and not letting it get old and stale.
Yeah. Did you say they put drugs in the water in the car ride over here?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and then their culture is the most impressive thing about them, because you go there and it's like everybody is like happy and smiling, and you feel like you're in like a weird version of, I don't know, some like cultish, you know, Mormon community. There, everybody's so happy and...
I would agree here, though. It's the simplicity of this, right? They never were chasing after whatever was hot in the market. A chicken sandwich didn't come out, and all of a sudden they had to be on top of the chicken sandwich. They're not making a salad bowl. They just do what they do, which is a hamburger. I actually think their fries are disgusting, but the hamburger is good, and it's just, I think it's consistent and quality. And also, when you go to fast food, you don't always get the most pleasant people. And I enjoy a kid who might possibly be on ecstasy taking my order, like maybe like petting the hair of his assistant next to him, like awkwardly. It's a very weird atmosphere and culture in there.
You can be this happy all the time without some external.
And what's the quality of the meat? I've had it. I thought it was good, and I like you can wrap it in lettuce like a celebrity.
I think nothing different.
Nothing different. Really?
Nope. Yeah. No one looks to the ingredients.
Don't you think it's Shake Shack par meat instead of McDonald's frozen meat?
No. It's actually not. They did that analysis of it I saw recently. It's commodity beef.
But I think we have in the East Coast, White Castle holds the space. This mythological. What are you nodding your head, Emily?
Of course it doesn't.
Except replace ecstasy with angel dust, and there you have it.
But there's no White Castles in Connecticut. Purely commodity beef patty better than McDonald's, which may be like 94% cardboard.
Yeah, I mean,
I would rather at least it to be beef if it's gonna, if it's gonna be a hamburger rather than who knows what's in an. You know, the kind of national,
it's
big national brand.
He said it's the same. It's actually not.
Yeah, but what he's saying is like it's commodity beef, but at least it's beef. Whereas McDonald's, you're like, well, I don't know.
Who knows how much of it is filler?
Is it also because it's regional? Like it's something that has the idea of it has traveled this way into the East Coast, and we crave it and we want it, and they're not opening here. Like I have friends that go to Bojangles in the South, and I don't think it matters what's in it.
Some of it is mythology, and also this like great California idea of the drive-through, like Hollywood has glamorized that thing, and then they took it and marketed it well, and it seems like it has this Fast Times at Ridgemont High feel. It's more they created a feeling of a hamburger place, of every California hamburger place. Yeah. And probably for Californians, it's a little bit nostalgic because you probably grew up with that type of hamburger place that wasn't In-N-Out.
You know, it's all of these things we're talking about, too, because they never, you know, they only grow as fast as their supply chain, right? And they're all self-owned, right? So they never exceed the buzz. Like, I never go to an In-N-Out and don't wait in a line. So it's like, yeah, like... It's a hot hamburger chain. They could take a ton of money, blow it up all over the nation, and then you wouldn't have to wait in line, and then they'd have to figure out how to, like, you know, hold the hamburgers to keep them hot, and then all this other stuff comes into it.
Ours was definitely made to order.
We were
the only one that probably didn't have a line, but the five was closed. The five was closed, so I think everybody else was off the highway, and we were the only ones.
But what prompted this question? Why are you interested in? I'm curious. It's kind of old, right?
Both of our distributors. I mean, we have a delivery service here. Our best meat friends, Pat LaFrieda Meats. He does the Shake Shack burger. On the West Coast, our distributor's Premier Meats, and they make the Shake Shack burger there. And so there's actually charming inconsistencies or little inconsistencies between the various Shake Shack burgers, meaning it's not the same burger all over the world, which is what launched Slow Food. If a fast food chain had opened and they were chefs and each burger was a little different because there was a guy picking and choosing how he was going to prepare it, or it came from different farms, it would be a bit more interesting. It was the homogenizing side of fast food that Slow Food hated. So I actually like that Shake Shack has different tasting burgers around the country, mm-hmm. and maybe sources smaller amounts from more people rather than everything from one farm.
Besides it being commodity, though, I believe that's how In-N-Out started. They followed their chain, so like they stayed close to where the lettuce was grown, where the tomato was. Like that's why they didn't really leave California to begin with, was because they wanted to stay close to the food chain. Now the problem was a lot of it was commodity, but they had carefully chosen what these commodity products were, and they felt like that was the best representation of the burger they were going to make. So they didn't want to expand outside of those regions where they couldn't get those same products. So in a sense, it's similar.
I think, you know, if we're sitting here in 10 years talking about Shake Shack and what they're doing, I think, you know, you could draw a lot. You'll be able to draw a lot of parallels and be like, oh, they control. You know, like I think In-N-Out went, and in a market that didn't care about controlling the supply chain, they did. 10 years ago, now there wasn't a movement for, commodity may have been the only thing that was available, but they were, they're very guarded about what they're bringing in through their doors, and that's why they don't expand. They control it from the whole.
How many are there? Do you know?
I know.
No, Em. Can we crack researcher? But I would like to know for each.
I will look it up. I will also say I remember reading Fast Food Nation in the early aughts.
Eric Schlosser.
And In-N-Out is like upheld as the model of a chain where the food is of a higher quality and the workers get paid better, and they are one of the few fast food places where workers' salaries are connected to what the minimum wage requirements are. So they've been getting like the state minimum wage. They've been getting at least 11 in California for some time now.
Fantastic. Interesting. Hmm.
Were you going to ask me? No.
No, I just like to have a gnome in my stable we so all I can
wanna,
call on him.
We all want a gnome in our back pocket.
Yeah, don't they have that in homes now? You're just like, what's the thing? And then it's
Alexa. 342.
You mean a gnome?
Echo. 342.
Everyone has a gnome in there.
Wait, Noam gave us a stat. What was that?
342 locations, and last year they did $575 million worth of business.
And can you compare that to Shake Shack? And while he looks that up, there was a funny what you just said, a gnome. There's actually a gnome up there. I love Steve Martin's medieval doctor on Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. where he's like, 20 years ago, we would have thought this sickness was caused by demons in their stomach. Now we know it's because a small midget is lodged in his stomach.
Shake Shack is 200 locations worldwide, 130 in the U.S., 70 international. And last year, or 2017, their revenue was about $350 million.
All right, they're catching up. They're catching up.
So well, can I switch over?
Yeah,
to
of course.
I was gonna say, you did hit on one very interesting point.
What,
Patrick.
Steve Martin, well, medieval doctor?
Like that, and also just that the we were talking about the difference in the taste of the meat in different Shake Shacks, and I have international locations, and there is a difference.
Which ones? Tell us.
Dubai, Bangkok, Singapore, and Japan.
That's impressive.
I can't even think about it. Thanks. I mean, I can't even remember. But each location, because of the different, you know, where we purchase from and the suppliers and the what we get, everything tastes a little different. Mm-hmm. And things look different. For instance, in Dubai, the egg yolks are a different color than they are in Japan and than they are in the U.S., which is very cool to me. They're very orange in Japan. They're a little bit more yellow in Dubai. Here in America, they're a little more golden. So things like that. The nuances are very interesting.
Can I ask you a question? Why do they need you? Why did they need to partner and make you an owner there? Why couldn't they just copy you? Is it just because of your big name?
No, or is it because is of the question is
know-how.
The answer. That is something I ask myself all the time, being someone who is very creative and will just produce. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that somebody would want to come all the way overseas and pick up a concept and then go and mimic it.
They did that with Egg, too, another breakfast place
here in
Brooklyn. Yeah.
Where did they recreate it?
Tokyo.
Oh. Yeah, so the other thing is, so everyone always asks, why the Asians? But just as Americans love Asian or, you know, sushi, so do Japanese, which was where we started, love American breakfast food and carbs. And when I went to Japan for the first time, has anyone been? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you go. All right, you're all great and awesome.
I haven't.
But it's not a sensual, sexy kind of a food. There's no sauces, really. It's all very minimal and serene and sparse. So they come to America and they have like fucking hollandaise bursting all over the runny yolk. And they're like, holy shit, their mind is blown. And it's all sopped up with heavy
carbs.
We'll
make you a 49% owner, please.
Seriously. And then you go to Japan and you're eating slippery okra and... You know, it's a whole different thing. So I understood when I actually went to Japan why they love our food so much.
Great answer. Now I have an answer for that.
There you go.
That's awesome. You were going to segue, Patrick?
Well, I read the Times.
I do too.
I get it delivered to my door old school. And the guy leaves me a tip request every December 1st.
I get the same tip request.
Do we have the same guy? Do
you think? It's from Neil. He leaves envelopes all over the city.
Is it true there's only one guy that does the whole city?
Well, ours is a gal.
All 4 million people. The New York Times ran a piece yesterday about stocking a modern pantry, which encompasses refrigerator, freezer, and cupboard items. The Times said that the pantry is an antique
cupboard.
Word.
Cupboard. I give it.
Cupboard.
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 A cupboard.
Anyway. So the Times says cooking is simpler and faster when you already have the ingredients. So what's happening?
I'll tell you what's happening here. This is another one of those condescending New York Times stories treating me like an idiot and insulting my intelligence like I don't know how to put fucking food in my kitchen. This is up there, those stories that are in the lifestyle section, like how to brush your hair or how to start a conversation at a party. You know, this is so fucking dumb that I don't even think we need to address this because I expect that every listener of this show knows that you should have like a box of pasta and a can of tomatoes in their goddamn kitchen.
These are the kind of rants that I really missed the 3 weeks that we had off. I was wondering what was missing in my life, and there it was.
Yeah,
it was just that moment where Mike gets to unjam himself all over the radio.
You do well to have some peanut butter and bread in your house.
Yeah, but the thing is that if you have an editorial background like I do, I don't even read that section because I know, I'm imagining what the editorial meeting was like and then who's talking, and then I know who the writers are. And it's like, do I care what they think in a meeting of what we all should read about with cupboard ingredients?
They're clearly going for a younger demographic. I mean, if you look at the explosion of toast, that's because, I mean, when I saw like toast became a thing, it's like, what, you don't understand how to make toast? You buy bread and you buy shit and you put it on there. But, you know, we're so disconnected from our food that now people are like, go pay other people to make them toast. It's phenomenal.
They pay $16 for avocado toast.
Yeah, it's like crazy.
Toast,
it's crazy. It's because, yeah, they don't, like, yes, I agree with you, Mike, except for the fact that I know for a fact there are people who are like, oh, yeah, I have to buy food before I have it. That's mind-blowing.
Yeah, I didn't realize like the stoner, you know, millennial contingent was such a big demo for
there
the
was also
Times.
A tip. There was
They're
a tip
not.
In the piece.
It's interesting that you said that. Sorry,
no,
Emily. I don't agree with you on that because I'm an avid New York Times reader, yep. And I read all the editorials, and I don't see many young millennials writing in op-eds or letters to the editor or... and what they're doing in the food section is they're skewing toward national. That's what they're doing. They're making a conscious skew towards national, which is why they just reviewed at San Francisco place or wherever, California. We're in fucking New York City.
Yeah.
And by the way, while I have the mic, and they still write about Mario Batali, who they should stop writing about, start fucking writing about young women and men, chefs and workers and people in New York City who are doing fucking cool things every day. Why am I reading about San Francisco in the New York Times?
Also, one of the things we've said in the previous shows is that the New York Times food section... great job.
Thank
Applause
you.
Button on, please.
Pete Wells, I don't want to read him anymore, but I would love if the food section had five shorter reviews of five different places all the time. Then it could go national, but then they could also truly cover New York.
Yeah.
Five different people, all the same five, but five different people. And then everyone would be like, this is my favorite of the five.
I am curious if that's how the LA Times is going to end up, because they're the ones that just appointed,
it's
I think,
the right
it's
way to
two
be.
Or three critics. And I don't know if they're each going to get a week or if they're each going to have a small piece.
I hope they're ballsy enough to each give them a small piece every week, because one review a week for a city like Los Angeles, that's absurd.
Which paper are you about to
but
tell
do
us?
You follow, no, do you follow food reviews? I mean, for me, that's like when I got into magazines and they gave the woman who shared the office with me, they're like, who wants to do horoscopes? And I was like, what? You could just choose somebody. It's not a horoscope artist, an astrology expert.
That's a horoscopist, I believe, is the word you're looking for.
That's right. Horoscopist. Colonoscopist?
Yeah. And now he is jammed.
I haven't had my horoscopy today.
That'll unjam
I'm gonna
you,
I'm
going
to give Mike. You a soup starter, and then that'll naturally ease you.
Oh, nice. No.
That wasn't the applause button.
So, by the way, I think the pantry question, what is more interesting, like, what do you go all out on and have so much. Like, I ordered from Cesare Gallen.
Yeah, what do you have, Patrick?
I have a shit
anchovies.
Ton of herbs.
Anchovies.
And spices from
Cesare. I was going to say anchovies.
I believe that. Anchovies.
Not for me. For him.
It's what separates you apart, not being the sheep. In your pantry, you should be judged by, I have 20 different kinds of anchovies. That's interesting. You have to go all out on one because everybody has
before
the core
break,
ones.
If someone comes to your house... You've unplanned, maybe you've been away for a week, whatever it is.
Anchovy with butter on toast.
Yeah, what is the one thing you always are going to have?
Anchovies with butter on toast, cheese.
No, wait,
and
you can't
salumi.
Have one.
Not a
one.
Dish,
one.
Just a thing.
One.
Daniel, what's yours?
Canned beans.
Okay, Mike.
Well, I was already thinking about the,
so artsy,
the
fartsy.
Grands and amphetamines that I have. That's more of an end of world kind of pantry scenario. you know what I'm big on? I like emergency pizza. I call it money in the bank.
Is it in the freezer?
It's in the freezer, and it's pizzeria pizza after we order.
Is it
pizza,
Roberta's? Pizza.
Sometimes it depends if I take it home. I'll pop it in the freezer because that's money in the bank, and there's always that. That's for, you know, always after a gig and breakfast if I don't have any soup, for example.
And just realize that the Paul Newman pizza, she got one somehow. I don't know how, and it's delicious. And now we always have a Paul Newman fortune. Cheese pizza in the freezer.
I didn't know Paul Newman was in
Quattro
the pizza business.
Quattro Fromaggio. I didn't know that either.
Dee Dee, what's yours?
You
Newman's
get,
Own?
Yeah, Newman's Own. You always get tuna fish because we're Jews. So two kinds, though. You get either regular canned bumblebee in water, or you get tuna fillets, which you get at Zabar's packed in oil. Estrusian oil? Did I make that up?
Do you live over Zabar's? You live
That's
over Zabar's.
She does.
The only thing that I have in abundance is hot sauce.
Oh yeah!
Just like I have
so
just
you have to
more.
Put it on your
I have.
Finger?
I just have. Yeah, I could actually, if I'm gone for a while, there could be like nothing in my refrigerator or cupboards. But there's they've so much hot sauce. I have so many bottles of hot sauce. It's kind of disturbing.
It sounds hot.
You should see me in the morning with my shirt off and all the hot sauce out, and I'm just staring at it like, what am I gonna do with all this hot sauce?
Minus cheese. There's always a.
We knew
a
this. Yes, we knew this.
You write that on your Instagram description.
Oh, you actually have checked out my Instagram recently.
I think I like photos more than you do. Emily's like, I'm not going to like any of your photos because I don't want you to come up in my feed. I'm like, thanks.
He was the only one coming up at the top. I was trying to push him down a little lower. Sorry. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Noam, take us away, and we'll be back in a bit.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
Reason to be alive. We'll take your time.
Right. All right. And we're back. You guys done chit-chatting over there?
Yeah.
All right. We are back. We're broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is the Main Course OG. I'm in studio with Patrick, Daniel, Mike, Dee Dee, Brandon, and myself, Emily. So, Dee Dee, welcome. You're our guest for the Weekly Grill today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So, Clinton Street Baking Company is very famous for pancakes. What's your favorite item on the menu? Do you even like breakfast is my question.
Thank you for asking. Well, my favorite item on the menu... first of all, we're not a breakfast restaurant. We've become famous for breakfast and brunch, but we're a full restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And my partner, who's also my husband, is a world-class chef who's been working in New York City for 40 years. So I always feel I have to defend ourselves, even though I shouldn't. But anyway, I love our Southern breakfast. It's an homage to my dad's side of the family, which is Southern roots, and it's fried green tomatoes, cheese grits, sugar bacon, and eggs any style. But I really love our fried chicken sandwich, which is like fucking gold star. It's like the Mercedes-Benz of McChicken sandwich. And the thing I like the best about it is that it's smeared with a lemon mayo, and then it has pickled green tomatoes, which we get from the pickle guys on Lower East Side. And then we make the bun. And our fries are hand cut, and it's just really delicious. It's our fried chicken. Our chicken comes from Bobo Chickens in Chinatown. Mm. Have you heard of them?
No.
They're Buddhist. Has anybody heard of the Bobo Chicken?
Head on, feed on.
Yeah, and they're blood. They're like bloodlet Buddhist style, which is supposed to be kind and loving, and Buddhistic. I made that word up. but honestly, it's a superior bird, honestly, and it's gorgeous. So. And no, I don't eat breakfast. I drink green juice every day religiously for like 15 years. Talk about a soup starter. And fruit. And then I eat at like noon after yoga. I'm very, very religious and ritualistic about my eating.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we can't tempt you with one of the scones you brought.
No, you totally can. I'm not a baby, but.
Where do we get a Buddhistic horoscopomy?
Yeah, there's a spa down the street.
I think you set up a tent.
That's funny,
by a tiki bar.
Yeah.
All right, and if you're up at Clinton Community on the Upper West Side, I mean, your restaurants, by the way, could not be on further opposite ends of the city.
Yeah, but it's only like 6 miles.
I could get to Philadelphia faster than I could to Community Food and Juice.
People say that.
He actually said that to me yesterday.
I took the subway this morning. It took 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And what were you going to ask about community?
Oh, just is there a is the menu very different?
Yeah,
is
it similar? That's boring. I mean, okay. I don't mean boring question, but I don't
know.
No,
I'll say
your
one thing.
Listeners.
Community Food and Juice is basically Columbia University's professor's
cantina.
Great. Cantina, exactly.
Thank you. I call it the academic power lunch. We're huge at lunch too, and then brunch, of course, and then dinner's really busy. In fact, when we opened because of Clinton Street's success, we thought immediately no one's going to show up for dinner, and everyone will be there first thing in the morning. And at 5:15 on the first night, we had like 50 people waiting online, and we're like, holy shit, this is a dinner business. This is crazy.
And you know, with intelligent clients like you have up at Columbia, which is an Ivy League school,
yeah,
it is amazing what cuisine they go to. It's, I've always said it, this Middle Eastern small sauce, plates of sauce like baba ganoush or cut up lettuce. It's Middle Eastern cuisine is the healthiest, most tasty, healthy, you know, vegetarian.
She's about
cuisine.
To tell you they don't have Middle Eastern.
We don't have Middle Eastern cuisine, but that's
no,
such
but
a
you
nice
do
spot.
Have those bowls.
Well, those bowls are Asian inspired, and actually, Asian, we were inspired by Ace in Venice, where my brother lives, near Giusta.
Oh, in Venice, California.
Venice, California. They were one of the first of the bowls. This was years ago, like 14 years ago.
Dipping sauces, right? Like, with pita.
He's still on that thread. So cute, Patrick. We don't do dipping. We have really cool bowls that are Asian inspired. Our food. Anyway, this is boring. Let me give you something more interesting.
All Let's right. My on. Next question was, you began your career as an editor and advice columnist at 17 magazines.
Yes.
We know you were sharing an office with someone doing horoscopes.
Yes.
So what did you learn there? No, well, I guess.
Yeah.
What?
Well, I learned everything. Honestly, I started there 7 days after graduation. I was 21 years old, and it was a very corporate professional position. I was there for 5 years, Midtown Manhattan, super duper corporate. I traveled a lot for work. I learned a lot about the corporate environment and professionalism. I learned a lot about journalism, believe it or not, even though our readers were adolescents. But that was really my target audience. I had studied adolescence in college, so this was like my dream job. I literally landed it before I graduated. I worked with top editors who went on to work at other magazines in Manhattan that were very, you know, reputable. And I learned a lot about style because I was a country bumpkin, and I just kind of got like a better haircut and better clothes, basically.
So like Devil Wears Prada, you showed up and she was like, we have to do something about this.
No, it wasn't like that at all. I did it for myself. But I will tell you that the cool thing that I did was I traveled a lot, like my third and fourth year there, and I was the editor of the food page, which for teenagers is like snacks. But I would call up in every city that we went to, like Austin or Nashville, and I would say, hey, I'm the food editor at 17 Magazine, which was true, and this is what you did, you know, in magazines. And I'm bringing in four editors, and we'd like to eat. And then, like you at Squirrel, like front of the line, you know, best table, the whole thing. And that was really cool, and that kind of launched me towards food.
You know, we were at the Good Food Awards, and they had like 500 artisans there, and they just launched a new snack category because it is really an American phenomenon, like cocktails and turkey and, you know, the snack. It's delicious and can be sustainable and have an art behind it.
Well, can we talk about Giusta? Because you said you want to, and it's snacky, and I thought the food there was so good.
I'm like a world
of them.
Sight.
It's so wonderful. And didn't you love the bathroom?
We went there eight times in 3 days.
Yeah, I went there twice. Did you see the wood toilet? It's very cool.
I missed it.
No, I don't need it. It's healthy. It doesn't come immediately.
I'm going to send Mike there. The bathroom is very cool there. You mentioned the bathroom where?
Oh, Lord.
It's so jammed up.
Oh, Lord. Why me?
I think we should send Mike as a bathroom reviewer. Like, there's a restaurant reviewer, and then somebody should review just bathrooms.
Okay, I'm going to start with Roberta's 5 stars. 5 stars on the new retro 70s wallpaper.
Unjam this man.
And by the way, I noticed the graffiti is already starting to climb up in the new wallpaper.
It's funny that it hasn't. I thought there would be more graffiti by now, to be honest with you.
I thought people would be terrified to do it. But
Mike, what's the toilet paper like? Softness, 1 to 10.
I heard they're looking for a campaign poster or advertisement for Brodo broth. Have you seen that? It's bone broth. I think you should be the face of it. That could be good.
Can I nominate Mr. Whipple to be in the Heritage Radio?
It's funny, though. I don't,
Hall of Fame because
I don't know about
that's a part of the business that gets often overlooked.
Mike is not prepared to be the face of anything. He could be the tail end of Brodo broth.
That's why I'm on radio, Brandon.
And he could also be the best. I know he would be the best at critiquing any bathroom in all of New York City, maybe all of the world.
But he needs Noam to follow him with sound effects.
Yeah.
Right?
You heard that coming, didn't you?
All right. Well, my next question, we have about 5 minutes left. Tell us what it's like being married to an old Jew.
Well, the reason why I'm so scatological with Mike answers your question. I have a deep understanding of scatology with my old Jew. No, Neil's favorite response is, you're only as old as the woman you feel.
Oh,
and I'm much younger than him, so I guess it works out.
What is your age difference, if I can ask?
Wait, not like the woman you feel inside, like, because I feel like a very young woman. Sometimes I feel like a very old woman. But you're talking about the woman that your hands touch, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Hot sauce. yeah. Oh, yeah. Our age difference is almost 14 years, which isn't a big deal when we first got married. But now that he's 60.
I'm 11.
I thought
with
you would
Anne.
Say it was a bigger deal then.
No, it was nothing then. And now it's just like, wow, I'm married to a 60-year-old. Yeah,
but that's
gotta sting.
But I'm married to a 60-year-old chef, and our fucking pantry's amazing all the time.
He's got it going together. He is hilarious. He's like the greatest energy in the room. Like
when
we went to Isodi and had dinner, like everyone was like walking by and looking at that guy because there's a lot of tetwar there.
Guys, I got the invite. Patrick couldn't make it, but they had a latke party. Oh my goodness! You have to get invited to this next year. They know what they're doing.
There is
caviar, Patrick's favorite.
Mike is so threatened right now.
I couldn't make it to yours.
I know, because you had to go to like some schmancy VIP vodka party because they bought you off with the caviar.
Over no, Zabar's.
Mike, we have three bathrooms.
My latke party this year was also a cat mitzvah.
I know, we know.
Three bathrooms.
That is exactly where you lost me.
Yeah.
Because I was like so in on the latke party. And then you're like, it's also a cat mitzvah. And like immediately my eyes swelled up. And I started scratching in my chest hair.
Have you ever been to Cat Cafe on Clinton Street?
I've been to other cat cafes.
He's been to their bathroom.
I want to rename that. I'm not going to say it. But
there's one on Atlantic too. There's a lot of them. Yeah.
It's very interesting. It's becoming Asian concept.
It's not beyond me to smoke half a joint and go into the cat cafe.
Oh, by the way, do you remember when you brought cats here, live cats, into Roberta's?
Oh my God. I did not bring them, okay? It was the Crazy Cat Lady show.
Brandon looks still pissed.
Yeah, and that was the day that Patrick like dosed me with like a pot cookie. It was on a beautiful spring day. Like, here, my friend made these cookies. Try one. And, you know, people are always giving me food here.
One of these chairs still smells like cat spray.
Oh my God.
That chair
I was just
to
getting
the
increasingly and increasingly that stoned chair. Until I realized that, oh, fuck, Patrick gave me a pot cookie without telling me, you know, which is seriously uncool. And then these crazy cat ladies brought all the kittens, like the rescue kittens, here. I'm like, fuck, this is a restaurant. You know, this is no good.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I'm gonna get kicked out.
Pot cookie plus kittens was pretty pleasant afternoon.
People were like, are there 10 kittens in the studio right now? People were eating dinner.
All right, Dee Dee, what's next?
Next for us.
What comes next for you guys at Clinton?
We're going to Time Out New York, Dumbo.
Wow.
Yeah, have you heard that?
Now that you say it, yes,
time
but I forgot.
Out. Time Are you
out.
Being serious?
Now, this is the space that
so
is taking...
Empire Stores. Yeah. So this is a food hall in Dumbo. I'm being interviewed by the Wall Street Journal today at noon. Yeah. Mm. About it. It's exciting because the location is just incredible. It's stunning and beautiful.
How many other places are going to be in there with
you? Well, they say 21, and right now I think there's about 12. It's an interesting lineup.
And you're bringing Clinton Street to that place?
Yeah, it's Clinton Street Baking Company, along
restaurant,
with others.
Restaurant, sit
down? No, it's a food hall. It's like a massive smorgasbord.
So you stand in line, get your food, then sit
in
the communal seating.
And there's a huge bar and then an upstairs rooftop deck.
It's beautiful
it's
there.
Gorgeous
you face
there.
The water and the carousel.
Yeah.
And
they also uninvited us. We were
actually
the very first people to have a deal with them, and they uninvited us.
Brandon, I believe it. I think
this
we're the last
the
people
truth.
That were
Well,
asked.
Actually, before Time Out took it, the Empire was going to run it themselves. They were going to run the food hall themselves. I think they got cold feet on also being operators of a food hall. So then in the transition, they pulled the rug from us. And then when Time Out took it, nobody came back looking
for
poor... Old, ugly.
I would have loved
gross
you guys,
Brandon.
Brandon,
but aren't you going to Domino Park instead? Did I just make that up?
Oh yeah, no.
Yeah, see, it's not so. And also, you're going to LA first class.
Yeah, but that would have been really
LA
fun
right
to be your neighbor. That would have been fun to be your neighbor.
You guys
also because I lived in downtown Brooklyn. I've lived in Fort Greene for 20 years, so I was kind of like, oh, this would be nice, like a new, like closer to my house. I could have something.
Yeah.
But yes,
you guys can like shuttle pizza over the Navy Yard
so that we could share the mic.
Scones and pizza can go because from Dumbo to the Domino Park.
I have to say, I've enjoyed sharing mic with you. It's been amazing. You.
No, the pleasure has been mine.
Did we just do the best 45 minutes of food radio this week around the world?
Absolutely.
I think we did.
Pat yourself on the Patrick back.
Oh, thank you. Mike, I know you're down there already. Three bathrooms. Next lockup party. Three bathrooms.
I want to see Mr. Whipple.
Do you really have three bathrooms?
All
two and a half.
All right. We'll be back next week. Our guests are, it's a Nordic show. Next week is all Nordic. Nordic people are coming. Oystein.
And Uli. All right. Stick around for Tech Bites up next at 11.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.